and welcome to Learning from Nature, the biomimicry podcast with me, your host, Lily Ehrman. Here we explore the wild and wonderful world of biomimicry, the practice and perspective of learning from nature's forms, processes, and systems to design a more life-friendly future. When we take time to really look and listen to nature around us, we might realize the infinite inspiration for how to better build, communicate, transport, manufacture, regenerate, and reciprocate. This episode wraps up season 2 on strategies in nature and is all about one of my favorite organisms to marvel at during hikes. It's a curious creature that is everywhere, but commonly overlooked. Lichen comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors, and if you bring a jeweler's loupe or magnifying lens with you while hiking, you can really immerse yourself in a beautiful symbiotic world of unique structures. My guest is Dr. Troy McMullen, the head of botany at the Canadian Museum of Nature and one of the foremost lichenologists in North America. He is the past president of the Field Botanists of Ontario, an adjunct professor at Carleton University, and a member of the Lichen Specialist Group for the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN. Troy has published extensively in both the academic and popular media spheres, and he is an experienced speaker who has given lectures, talks, and interviews across North America and beyond. His most recent book is titled Lichens, The Macro Lichens of Ontario and the Great Lakes Region of the United States. Well, I'm going to have you introduce yourself and please state your pronouns as well.
Sure. Hi, I'm Dr. Troy McMullen, he, him, from the Canadian Museum of Nature. I'm a research scientist in lichenology and the head of botany here at the museum.
Amazing. And lichenology is something that fascinates me. Lichens are something we see everywhere. I see everywhere on hikes, even in the winter, especially in the winter when everything else is hibernating or dormant. Lichens are something I especially notice. So I'm excited to get into it with you.
That's
How
great.
Did you get interested in lichens and what got you into lichenology?
I kind of fell into lichens and I was a lifelong naturalist and everything interested me. But I was actually a high school teacher. And decided to go back and do a master's to progress my teaching career. And so I decided to do something I was passionate about rather than something that, I was looking for a career in necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and did a master's on defining old growth forests. What are old growth forests? What species are unique to old growth forests and how much old growth you need to preserve those unique species is the questions that I was looking at. And so I was looking at the species that are unique to them and I said, what would be the best organism to sort of help answer these questions? And lichens kept coming up. And There's lots of species that only grow in old growth forests. And so I got started on them, thought, how hard can these things be? And I never looked back. I've been working on them ever since and still trying to figure them out.
Okay, old growth forests are so cool, and I have potentially some questions around that for later. But first and foremost, what are lichens?
It's a very complex answer because they don't fit any classic definition of what we have for species. So they are, largely two things working together. They're a mycobiont, so a fungus, and that's the bulk of what you see. A fungus makes up 80 to 90% of a lichen, and then it's working together with a photosynthesizing partner, which is usually an algae. Sometimes it's a cyanobacterium, and sometimes it's all three of them working together, which is just incredible because they're all in different kingdoms. Like they're very distantly related, but they've all figured out a way to work together. And so that's sort of the core of it, but there's also, like any organism, they've gotten some attention lately for the microbiome that's part of them. The bacteria and the fungi that are also a part of that complex system, and just like it's a part of us. But really, the core of what we're talking about is a fungus and a photobiont.
I think it's really fascinating because there's so much more of this working together out in nature than I think a lot of us initially realized, especially folks who aren't in, the biological realm. and for so much of our history was, you know, competition is how evolution works, not necessarily cooperation. And I'd love for you to maybe talk a little bit more about this idea of a symbiont or what symbiosis really is. I think, especially in the biomimicry space, symbiosis is really talked about, but maybe not deeply understood. So if you can give a quick definition of what symbiosis is and what it means for lichen, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Well, the word symbiosis was created for lichens.
Whoa.
You're looking at two partners benefiting, or three, or multiple partners benefiting from a relationship. It's really a symbiosis. And that's what's happening here. So some people have defined it as a fungus that's discovered farming, or just, you know, they're like imprisoning and making the algae do their bidding. But that's humanizing it a bit too much. They're both benefiting, right? Fungus normally lives in soil, lives in wood, beneath the surface, and it's getting its energy from whatever it's living in. And when you see a fruiting body pop out, you're seeing the reproductive structure. The bulk of it lives inside the structure. And then, you know, algae is quite ubiquitous. The tiny algae that lives in lichens is kind of everywhere, but not all places. So when the two come together, they're able to now come out of the wood, come out of the soil, inhabit areas that they couldn't on their own. So they're both benefiting in that they're able to live in new places. I mean, they can colonize a bare rock.
The rock.
Because when they come together, and they can now, they're self-sustaining. They're photosynthesizing, getting their carbohydrates and nutrients, and they're getting their nutrients and minerals from the water that's washing over them. Or directly from the atmosphere. And so they don't need any substrate. They're not getting anything from what they're living on. So really, this relationship, this symbiosis is allowing these organisms now to colonize places that they couldn't colonize before, and more extreme places where other organisms typically cannot live.
Right. And they're really good at this, right? Like are they on every continent? Did I hear that somewhere?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like Antarctica is the best example. I think there's three plants, like vascular plants, known from Antarctica, but there's hundreds of lichens.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So this partnership has enabled them to live on every continent and in pretty much every ecosystem.
Every terrestrial ecosystem.
Every terrestrial ecosystem, right. So we're kind of getting into it here. What are the different kinds of lichens? I've seen these long stringy lichens hanging off of tree branches. And then you mentioned this kind of more smaller lichen that can grow on the surface of a rock. What are those different kinds?
Right. So there's, you know, like any good field of science, it's got its own language, and lichenology is no different. And it's one of the reasons it's hard to initially get into any field, including lichenology, is there's a lot of different terms. So the broad classifications for lichenology in terms of forms, you know, so I like to compare lichens to coral reefs, because people are familiar with coral reefs. And so you can talk about brain coral or fan coral, and people get an idea of what you're talking about. There's forms like that for lichens as well. And we call them folios, is the one that stands out for a lot of people, because it looks like foliage. They just look like leaves. And the general rule for folios forms are that they have they're dorsiventral, or they have a different upper surface and a different lower surface. So the color is different, texture is different, the chemistry is different. And I'm assuming that is why Linnaeus, back in the day, he called them lower plants. Hmm. And it's probably because of these folios ones that look like plants. And that's probably why lichenology is generally included in botany, but not in mycology, even though they are fungi. So that's the case here. Like, I work at the Museum of Nature, where I'm in the botany department. It's all vascular plants, algae, and lichens, but no mycology. That's a completely different part of our government. And that's pretty much a divide that's been there ever since the NAES classified them that way. That continues today.
Does it make sense?
No, not at all. I mean, we're studying, they're fungi. There's fungi, you know, a popular term these days is that they're just fungi living a particular lifestyle.
Right.
And that lifestyle is working with a photobiont. But the short of it is they're fungi. And so they were more successful as a fungus than they were, sorry, as a lichen than they were as a free living fungus. So you can imagine that it would get complicated if you're doing genetic work and you can sample something that is living, like a free living fungus, and a fungus that is lichenized, you can get the same answer. But most of the ones that were free living have disappeared. They're more successful as a lichen, so they carry on as a lichen.
Interesting.
So it's usually only, they're only lichenized is what I mean.
So we got these lichen that look like plants, that look like leaves, foliage.
Right.
What else?
Yes. So, sorry, I got a little tangent.
No, it's fine. There. I welcome distractions.
The others are fruticose, they're called. And those are the hairy ones that you know, the old man's beard or horsetail, they call them.
Do you think this is turkey tail?
Oh my God. Look at this fungus.
We've really only gone 1 mile.
And they're hanging off the trees that are just like branches. And they're the same on all sides. It's one way of defining it compared to the folios ones. They've got no upper and lower surface. They're just sort of branches. So the reindeer lichens also fit into that category. Those ones, the spiky ones that grow on the ground, they're just, you know, they're just sort of round branches that are the same on all sides. So those are the fruticose lichens.
And can I ask a quick follow-up question about fruticose?
Yeah.
Because the other ones make so much sense with the name, like foliage, and then I won't hint at the other one, but is it like, are there a lot of fruiting bodies on fruticose, or is it just the structure alone that is kind of determining that name? But my brain just went there, and I'm wondering if you have any insights on that.
No, I think it's a great question, and one that I've never really thought about. Like, folios makes sense. The other one is crustose. It looks like a crust, but what's special about this term? I don't know the answer. I'd like to know as well.
Yeah, fruticose, because they all have fruiting bodies, right?
They don't all. I mean, they all can potentially produce fruiting bodies, but most, about half in some, it depends on your environment, but let's say it's about half the time they're producing sexually and half the time they're producing vegetatively, and they're not producing fruiting bodies. But they can.
Okay. So we have folios and we have fruticose. And then you mentioned crustose. What makes crustose different?
This lichen, which was everywhere, both folios and crustose and fruticose lichen, covering logs and branches in the Bay Area, is so beautiful.
So it's important also to note that those first two are considered the macro lichens. So macro lichens are just ones you can peel off the surface. So yeah, either of those, the hairy ones or the leafy ones, you can just peel them. They're growing on top of the surface. You can peel them off. But the third form type is crustose, and they're growing within the substrate. So, and they're considered the micro lichens. And it's not necessarily because they're smaller, because you can get really massive like coverage of these things, but it has to do with their inability to peel them off. So if you want to study a micro lichen or a crustose lichen, you have to take the substrate with you. You've got to cut away the bark, chip away the rock. The micro lichens or crustose ones are far less studied than the macros.
I love crustose lichen. I'm a big rock climber, and I always notice crustose lichen, the bright orange lichens and the bright green lichens. And this follow-up question just popped into my head. How do they attach to their substrate if they're so linked? What does that look like?
Right. Well, I mean, picture the densest rock you can think of, you know, like really hard granite, and it's hyphae, right? Like fungi is comprised of hyphae or mycelium, right? These little tiny strands. And they're so fine that they can grow in between the space and the crystals of a dense rock.
Wow.
And that's how they become one with it. They're growing into that empty space there. And they don't grow deep usually. So like it's usually less than a millimeter kind of thing. But they do become one with it. Like you can't, there's no way, there's no lower surface, I guess is the way of putting it, because all the mycelium is growing right into the substrate and becoming one with it.
And this
helps to create soil, right? I think I read somewhere, I don't know if this is accurate, maybe you can confirm this, that lichens are one of the biggest creators of soil in evolutionary history.
Yeah, for reasons that you might not think, though. So,
okay.
You know, a volcano erupts in the middle of the ocean. There's not much that can grow on that bare rock, but lichens can, because they're self-sustained little packages, right? They don't need soil. They don't need anything else. So, but what they do is they provide texture. So they do break down the rock slowly over hundreds, thousands of years. They can help turn it into soil, and there's like acids in them. But I think the thing that they do more than anything else is that they provide texture, and now soil that's blowing can get caught on it. And so you can get little ridges of soil building up. And now you can get some moss growing on that little ridge, or even some seeds and some plants growing. And they can provide more texture. And I think that's more of how they sort of start that process.
Interesting. So they're really important for that kind of early stage ecosystem then.
Massively. To be honest, they have an important role in almost every stage of development in almost every terrestrial ecosystem.
Whoa. Lichens are so important.
Yeah.
Do you feel like lichens are well enough studied?
Oh, no. We're still scratching the surface about every aspect of lichenology, you know, even from how to classify them, how to, you know, more recently, a number of people proposed that they be considered ecosystems because instead of individuals. And that was well received until someone very recently published a paper saying, well, no, here's the definition of an ecosystem. Ecosystems are bigger than communities. And like you're talking about more than a community. And so we still don't even have a good definition for
what
a lichen is, right? Like, what do you measure? Do you measure, if you're going to do a phylogenetic study, do you look just at the fungus? Do you look at the collaboration of the fungus and the photobiont? You know, like we're still in some early stages of just of classifying, figuring out how to classify them, what to call them, and then even understanding, you know, exactly what they do. Like, you know, there's like, how is it that they disperse? Like, there's still lots to learn about how they disperse, how they recolonize areas. You know, there's some species that live in old growth forests that live in these tiny little cracks and crevices. And it always amazes me. Like it's easy to understand how one that grows and produces vegetative structures that a squirrel runs over and picks it up and drops it off on the next tree, that sort of thing. But there's other ones where it's definitely spores floating around, but where are they getting this weird photobiont that they're working with? And, you know, how are they finding each other and then finding that right habitat? And lichens, you know, to answer your question, it's just so many layers. Lichens produce over 1,000 chemicals that aren't produced anywhere else in the natural world. And we know very little about the vast majority of them, about what they could do for us for medicine. That's the big one.
And that's a question too, before we dive into kind of the uses, which I'm fascinated by. And I've heard a lot about, especially like Usnea or that old man's beard lichen, how it's antibacterial, antimicrobial.
That's right. That's one that we do know a lot about.
Yeah. And so I want to ask you about that, but I want to back up really quick because you mentioned something about spores. And I want to just kind of give an overview of how lichens reproduce. Can you share maybe a little bit of their life cycle and then how they kind of make more lichen?
Sure. So, you know, when a fungus that's living in wood or soil pops out a mushroom, that's just the reproductive structure, right? And then it's producing spores that float off. And when those spores find a happy place to live, they'll live there. So for lichens, those that are producing sexually do the same thing. The fungus produces spores and shoots off its spores, and those spores float around. And those spores have to find their photobiont for a lichen to grow. So they have to find their partner in the right environment for it to grow. And
that's cool. Yeah, so not guaranteed that they're going to settle if they don't find their partner.
Exactly. Their partner in the right place. But what you may notice if you start looking closer is that lichens are often clustered together. You'll often get, you know, a tree really covered with lichens and another one not so covered with lichens in a similar environment. And one of the reasons is that a lot of the times it's getting the photobion from other lichens. So those spores will land on other lichens and germinate and take some of the algae that's in the other, you know, start using the algae that's in the other lichen. And then there becomes this like battleground. And that's why you see lots of them. So I kind of describe it as lichens like to hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, right? Like they're sharing their photobiont. And then, you know, but if there was no initial lichen to start the whole process on a tree, you might get a tree that's virtually empty and another one totally covered.
And that brings me to a question that I was just thinking about this weekend when we were snowshoeing in the mountains. And these, I think they were, you know, white bark fir or fir species had so much of that usnea lichen growing all over it. And at some point I asked, is this good for the tree? Or is it, I mean, I know they're not parasitic, but what impact does, you know, these fruticose lichens completely covering most branches of a tree can't be good for it, right?
Exactly. I remember being on top of Whistler in BC once, and the trees there, just the top of Whistler, are just covered with this brown horsehair lichen, and so densely you can't even see the needles anymore. And my only thought is that it can't be not causing
right.
some stress, but they're not taking anything from the tree. And I get called on a regular basis, say, oh, like there's this thing growing on my tree. Does that mean my tree is sick or unhealthy? And for the most part, the vast majority of the time, it's the opposite, right? It's because in the city, so lichens are very sensitive to air pollution, so they don't grow very much in cities. So people aren't used to seeing trees covered with stuff, but that's what's supposed to be there. That's what it's supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm.
So very young trees, which, you know, we're cutting a lot, so you know, a lot of the forests are young, or people live in urban centers. So they're not seeing trees the way they're supposed to be. When they're older, they should be dripping with lichens. You know, like the whole, like the whole trunk, the branches. That's when you know you've got a healthy environment that hasn't been disturbed in a long time.
And those old growth trees can handle that much lichen because they have so many other branches and needles to photosynthesize then, right?
That's right. So when we're talking about those, that initial, like what you just mentioned, when there was just completely covered, it's, you know, now this is the first time I've ever thought of this, but, you know, it's often the dead trees that get really, really coated like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a relationship. I don't think they killed the tree, but I wonder if that's just sort of a natural process that's happened. So I don't really have a clear answer.
Yeah, it's something that I think cases, about too.
Yeah,
I know nothing about lichens.
Yeah, but here's a good example of when, you know, I got called once to go and look at these trees. An organization that had a whole bunch of lilac trees, like fields and fields of lilacs, and they kept dying. They didn't know why. And one of the proposals was like, well, they're covered with lichens, so are the lichens killing them? I came there and said, are there any lilacs that are not dying? And they said, yeah, there's a batch over there. Are they covered with lichens? Yeah. Okay.
Well,
you know, lichens aren't really, you know, they're not the cause.
Right. And in fact, they're a really important part. You kind of mentioned this old growth idea. I'd love to get more into that, like why they're such an important part of that ecosystem and why they're an indicator of a healthy ecosystem.
Right. Well, I don't like to use the word health because, you know, in a young forest, that's healthy for the young trees that are there, and it's healthy for the lichens that like young forests.
Yeah.
So I like to use the word ecological integrity or the word continuity to describe an area. So if you're looking at a forest that's never been, that, you know, that hasn't had any major disturbances, it might have been a forest on that site for 1,000 years, 10,000 years, right? So the biodiversity cycles. And so most of our definitions of old growth would fit if you looked at, say, an island in the middle of the ocean, you cut all the trees down, you plant new trees, in 200 years, you're gonna have big 200-year-old trees, and that would fit most definitions of an old growth forest, but the biodiversity is not going to be there. So the continuity is like if you had left a patch on that island and there and all the spores and seeds for the organisms that live in old growth, then they can move out easily and recolonize those other forests. If not, you're talking about stochastic events and things that are taking, it's going to take thousands and thousands of years for biodiversity to move back into an area. And so that's what continuity is when those thousands of years have happened. And so the trees aren't thousands of years old, but it has been a forest there. So the biodiversity that's there is thousands of years old.
Right. And so lichens like that spot, right? This kind of more biodiverse, you mentioned healthy or clean air, you know, less air pollution. How is that related?
So as I mentioned, lichens get their minerals and nutrients directly from the atmosphere and from water that washes over them. They're like little sponges and they're just eating what floats by. So if there's acid rain, if there's pollutants in the air, they're going to take them in. And that's why they don't do well in cities. Mm-hmm. Because of the air pollution. And but that's not the case for all of them. There are some lichens that actually like city environments to a point. And there's some that, there's a whole gradient of things that they like. So the species that will only live in the cleanest of clean air and only in old growth forests, you know, there's a suite of those. And then, but there's a suite of ones that like middle-aged forests, and there's a suite of ones that like younger forest. So it's not just all lichens, you know, it's to say like whole growth forests are important for a very specific group of lichens.
And this is, I think, a really important conversation, especially in Canada, but here in the US and the Western US as well, around logging and trying to figure out how to help create these more biodiverse forests and not just, you know, clear cut areas and then destroy that habitat and the ecosystem. But I'd like to hear your thoughts on like how lichens can be part of that conversation, how they can contribute to conservation efforts, or what it looks like to, you know, bring lichens into the conversation around old growth and helping to create those ecosystems moving forward.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. It's one I've done a lot of work on, and something that I feel very passionate about as well. And really, you know, that's where I started down this road, was because lichens are such good indicators of like identifying areas of high conservation value. And so essentially, you know, if you can have an old growth forest that's near a city and that might not have many old growth species in it. And that's because of the air pollution. So it's not necessarily the best environment. You can have, anyway, if you're cutting, you cut a forest and you plant, you're not replicating natural disturbance, right? You're often not leaving legacy trees. You're not leaving, so legacy trees are just trees from the previous generation that might hold on to some biodiversity that can repopulate that forest once it gets a little bit older. But you're also, if you're planting, like let's say you're not getting the same amount of variation in light coming into the forest, you know, you end up with this really dense, you know, dark canopy. And that's not very good for lichens. There's so many different aspects of how you can do it. Like lichens can tell you when you've got an older forest, when the air quality is clean. But in terms of harvesting in the best way for lichens, you know, I've done some work on leaf blocks where foresters will leave a sort of representative block. And it's shown that those, you know, can be helpful to birds and other things. But for lichens, there's a big edge effect. You know, it's been found to be 50 to even 200 meters in from an edge, where the wind can change the moisture levels, and the wind can change the dispersal patterns, and so things are going to get drier. Light levels can change, and So there's going to be this big effect. So it's so much more than just the area that you cut, right? There's just so many more variables to
include. Yeah. And this is going to be crucial because old growth forests are, and old growth ecosystems and healthy biodiverse ecosystems are going to be a really important component, I think, to adapting to climate change and climate chaos. I think I'd prefer that term. Yeah. I'm like halfway in reading Suzanne Simard's book, Finding the Mother Tree, and I'm sure you're familiar with her work. Yes. And for folks who want to learn more about this kind of old growth idea and understanding forests and ecosystem ecology, that's a good read. And I'm curious how people can start to think about lichens in new ways or tap into this interest when they're out on a hike, or if you have some recommendations for folks who are interested in this, maybe you've never thought of lichens, but how they can start to, yeah, build that curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just sort of moving into that and away from conservation is that, like, there's so little old growth forest left, right? And we're in a biodiversity crisis, and that's a crisis in our backyard. But the species that need old growth forests are in peril, right? And and we're still having to fight to save the tiny little scraps of old growth that are left. And, you know, it really shouldn't be the case. So identifying, you know, so I mean, the number one thing for me in that light is to say, just leave the forests. And, but what people can do in that vein, they're interested for with lichens is to learn your lichens well enough to be able to recognize those that are really rare and illustrating them. They're one of the best indicators of the, you know, this long continuity old growth forest. And so they can be used to help guide management practices. And people do listen. You know, I published a paper a couple of years ago just on this very topic, just saying that we need to look at the biodiversity directly. Like the definition, it was driving me crazy that there were so many definitions of old growth, and a lot of them benefited the people that come up with the definitions. Like, this is how we define old growth, and that suits us well for our harvesting practices or whatever, right? But they're always defined based on coarse-weighted debris, pit and mound, age of the trees, blah, blah, blah. But ultimately, don't we care about them because of the biodiversity, you know, the special biodiversity that they have? So why aren't we just going in and measuring the biodiversity directly? And the argument always is, well, there aren't experts around. People don't know. They don't know their lichens or whatever organism. And so that would mean my roundabout way of answering your question is that people who cared about conservation and lichens, like, learn your lichens well enough that you can go out and use them as a case example as to why a stand should not be cut.
Yeah, especially for this unique organism that is everywhere that a lot of folks don't really know about or know how to identify, including myself. I think I can identify the three different kinds pretty well, but then you start thinking about species and looking at, you know, potentially the spores, which gets really scary because that's really hard to do. But being able to identify a few, I think, is a really powerful response to that. And this idea of citizen science, or, you know, recording your observations in one of those apps like iNaturalist, or there's, I forget the other one, but just being a part of that recording process, because it does end up sometimes really helping those ecosystems and making a case for keeping them the way they are.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious what your favorite lichen is and why.
Well, that's kind of like choosing your favorite children.
Right. maybe harder or easier said than done.
Yeah, but I do have some for sure. There's two, I think there's two front runners. One only lives in the Arctic, and it's called orange chocolate chip lichen. It's this bright green lichen, and its fruiting bodies are brown and immersed, so they look like chocolate chips, you know, in a cookie.
Hmm.
But the lower surface is that bright fluorescent orange that you were talking about that you like to see on the rocks. But just the lower surface of this one has that same chemical. It's an anthraquinone, and it's like fluorescent orange with this, you know, bright green, chocolate chips in it, and then the edges peel up. And you can get, it gets this like frilly, bright orange outline. It's really spectacular.
So easy to spot, potentially, <Yeah. laughs> especially in the Arctic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it is. You get your eye for it. And then the other one that is going back to old growth forests. This is a group called the Glass Whiskers, and they only grow about a millimeter tall, but they look like little truffula trees.
These truffula trees are just what I need.
They're full of color. There's spectacular little organisms, and they are incredibly rare. Like, they're one of the best indicators of true old forests with long continuity.
And this brings me to a point, because you have a great book that has spectacular images of so many lichens and full descriptions where you can find them. It's a really amazing book. I've gotten to look at it, and I'd love for you to share about your book and where people can find it, because I think it's a great place. I mean, it's much more in depth, but it's a really great resource for folks to have if they're getting into lichens.
Yeah, thank you. I came in, did my PhD in Ontario, and I grew up in Ontario as well. And it's got a special place. My job right now is to study lichens across Canada, essentially. But I grew up in Ontario, and that's where I still live. And so when I moved back there to do my PhD and my postdoc, I started studying the lichens in Ontario more intensively. When I arrived, there was about 750 species known, and myself and others, there's a number of people running around looking for lichens, and it's increased now to about 1,100 species just in Ontario. But I really started to notice that all the macro lichens were flatlining. You know, we're almost never finding new macro lichens to the province. We're usually finding the micro lichens, the crustose ones. And that's when I knew, you know, it's time. We're ready for a book, so that when somebody opens that book, the species is going to be, you know, if someone finds a species in Ontario, it's going to be in that book, essentially, is the how it was born. And so it really covers a lot of the Arctic along the Hudson Bay coast. It covers the Hudson Bay lowlands, which is for their own wetland unique ecosystem, and the boreal forest, and then all the Great Lakes region, and then Carolinian. So it's a lot of different ecosystems. So there's a lot of species in there, and they are sort of the same species that you'll see all around the Great Lakes and even beyond. So it's useful in a much wider context.
Yeah, it's really, really fabulous book. And I haven't been up to the Great Lakes region, but I'd love to, and I'm definitely going to bring my lichen book. And it's amazing that you increased that total species count from 750 to 1,100 with some folks in the last few. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's, you know, it just shows how much there is still to learn. I think that's the case in most states, provinces. If you had a really intensive look at it, you're going to find lots of new state or provincial records.
And that's largely
because, though, historically, there might have been somebody who was studying lichens, say, in Colorado, which there was, actually, in the 50s, 60s, in the 70s, I think, was the people were really focused on Colorado. But we've learned a lot since then, you know, and there's been more keys, and there's just, so it's just having an updated reference where it's something comprehensive. That's one of the things that makes my book unique as well, is that there aren't very many comprehensive guides, where it includes everything in a region. Most field guides that they're kind of like, these are the common species of this region, are more broad. So this one, my goal was to sort of take, to make lichens accessible, but not lose any of the data. Like, lichens have largely been written for, like, lichen work and tools have been largely academic in the past for a more academic audience. I wanted to bring that to the public, but also still include all the details that you need to get involved. One of the goals in my position as Canada's lichenologist was to bring lichens to the public more, because in the past it was largely an academic pursuit.
I definitely can understand that, because I, as a kind of hobby naturalist, and biomimic, and somebody who's interested in kind of environmental studies and biology, it was still tricky to understand and access that information or start to try to identify. So I can totally understand how it's for your, you know, everyday hiker who just wants to explore lichens. Those comprehensive guides are, one, harder to find, or two, just really difficult to understand sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And so I was hoping to bridge that. And so everything you could need, like all the tools you need, are in that book. To
get started. They really are. And is it the version, did I get sent a version? There's like a kid's version? Because that book is so cool.
Thanks. That's completely different.
So different, but yeah. A really thin, small book that I really loved. I was like, I would bring this out in the field with me because it's so small and light, and it does a really good overview of just like the differences of these different kinds of lichen and how to spot them and some interesting facts about them. So as an adult, yeah. I enjoyed that.
Nice. So that's just an introduction to Young Naturalist is what I called it, for lichens. But the only problem with it is that it's very broad. It's got a collection of interesting lichens from around the world in it. So it's not going to be great for using as a tool in any one region, but it's a good introduction to say these things are really incredible organisms, and here's some of the more amazing looking species.
Yeah, it's definitely more of the hook. Like, let's get you hooked on this. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I have one more question for you, and this kind of relates to it, but I'm actually going to ask a precursor question because I realized we didn't really get to kind of come full circle on one of the points that I mentioned earlier around how fascinating and important lichens in medicine could be. And I know this is not necessarily your field of study, but if you can mention maybe how lichens, what we know of, you know, the few lichens that have medicinal benefits or antimicrobial properties, or any other uses that we know of for lichens.
Sure. So as I mentioned, over 1,000 lichens are produced, or over 1,000 chemicals are produced in lichens that aren't produced anywhere else in the natural world. And those chemicals have been used as dyes historically. There's recipes going back almost 2,000 years using lichens as dyes, and they're still used today in Harris tweed. It's a famous one. And they fix very well. You know, prior to synthetic dyes, they were used regularly. So that was more of their historical uses. But then medicinally, they are used around the world in various ways. And the most famous of those uses is usnic acid, which is in old man's beard, the bright yellowy green hairy stuff you see growing from the trees. It's also on the rain. A lot of the reindeer lichens have it. It makes them kind of like this fluorescent yellow, green, pastel color. It's really beautiful. But there's indigenous groups around the world who have independently been using this as an antibacterial tincture and ointment. And it was actually used in the in Finland. It became a used in an industrial scale. They were producing like a tube called Usno, is the product. The acid, and it was just like polysporin. It was like a cream like that, and it grew. It became a massive industry, but it collapsed because lichens grow very, very slowly, and they couldn't keep up with the needs of it. And so that's just one chemical.
Yeah,
1,000 chemicals now. You know, I've seen some work that's been done on one chemical that was having a positive effect on Alzheimer's. I just read one study about that. You know, we don't know so much about them. A few years ago, I sent 10 chemicals off to somebody who was studying like their effectiveness on cancer, and just, you know, took them to a cancer lab. So that could be done with all 1,000, you know, chemicals. Like, so there's still a lot to learn. They're not just smears on a rock. Really. Mm-hmm. I remember the first day I started studying them, I went and talked to a professor who used to study lichens, and he said, no one wants to give you any money to study lichens. They're just smears on a rock. No one cares. They're so important ecologically. They've got so many potentials to help humanity. They're such great indicators of pollution, and you know, they can tell you where you probably should buy a house and where you shouldn't in terms of air quality. Like, they offer all these wonderfully free services, and all you have to do is know how to identify them.
We got some work to do.
Yeah.
Okay. My last question, finally, last question, I promise, is I'm wondering if you have like a weird or fun fact that you like to say about lichens. Maybe you've already said it, but that kind of other people might hook on to.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I like to say about lichens. Well, one of them, it's always worth mentioning that a bunch of lichens were taken to the International Space Station they were taken there for a year and a half and let out into space, into full gamma radiation, no oxygen, all the intense.
That's wild.
Yeah, and then brought back to Earth, and like 80% of them started doing their thing and they were fine.
So they just kind of paused. They were just like, okay.
Yeah, and which is how they kind of function, right? Like they live in the desert. They just kind of have to pause until moisture comes along. Like lichen growth is based on the amount of time they receive light while wet. So they go very, very slowly in the deserts, and they just kind of are almost hibernating until water comes along. So that same property can let them live in space, right? And who knows, a year and a half, they could travel through space.
So that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Is that similar? I'm getting ahead of myself, but I shouldn't ask you any more questions, but I have one more question. Is that similar to when they did like the tardigrades in space and they desiccated and they just kind of like paused their functions?
Amazing. I don't know. They could have, it sounds like it would have been part of the same.
Kind of similar.
Yeah. This was out of the International Space
Station. Such a fun fact that they were fine when they came back down.
Yeah.
There's a lot we can learn there for biomimicry. Yes.
Yeah, very true. Well, I also think, for anyone, there's like, for myself included, I was never, as a naturalist, I mean, I was always, I've grown up all my life being really interested in the natural world, and lichens were never part of that. You know, there's just this blur in the background. Mm-hmm. I never really ever dialed into them. And so what I would say to people, if you want to learn the biodiversity that's in your backyard, these things are everywhere. They're on the trees in your front yard. They're on the sidewalks. They're in every park that you go to. Like there's over 5,000 species in North America, north of Mexico.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you go. And once, I call it getting your lichen eyes. Like once you start to see them, you can't not see them. They're going to be everywhere. And they're this incredible life form. They're like a coral reef. They're just smaller, right? Like they've got all the colors, of the rainbow. They've got these wild shapes. And they're really ecologically important, very sensitive. So I call them the coral reefs of the terrestrial world. And once you get dialed into them, you'll start seeing them everywhere. You'll get your lichen eyes. And once you start learning about them, you'll start to appreciate just this magical world that's probably overlooked most of your life.
Totally. And my recommendation for folks is to get a jeweler's loop or a few and get down on your hands and knees. And fully immerse yourself in that world, because I can look at lichens for hours with my jeweler's loop, because it will zoom you in, not a ton, but 10x I think, or 15x maybe, and then you're in that structure and you can see all the little crevices and the different colors and the fruiting bodies, and it's a whole miniature world. And I take jeweler's loops on all the hikes I do with folks, because it's a really good way to get a different perspective. And I think for lichens, sometimes it is needed, because like you said, otherwise they can so easily be overlooked.
Exactly. And there's so many really minute species, the big showy ones, there's old man's beard that can grow meters long, or just the ones that there's like plates that grow on rocks that can be like a foot or two wide. And they're really spectacular and easy to spot, but there's ones that are a millimeter tall that look like truffula trees, right? It's worth getting in there to have a look, and really helps to illustrate just like how much we don't know. When we're talking about conservation, that we target like one or two species, and there's so much more to the whole system, right? Like preservation should be looking at big tracts of land.
So true. We might have to do a follow-up episode at some point. I love lichens so much. Troy, is there anything else you want to share around books or anything in your own kind of personal realm that you want to share for folks, or any last words?
No, I think I covered it in that last rant.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate your time today. This was a really wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Learning from Nature, the Biomimicry podcast. I'm so glad you're here, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I wanted to announce that we have some really awesome nature nerd merch, like shirts and stickers, so you can help support the podcast and look cool on your next hike. These were custom designed by my friend and incredible artist, Sarah Williams, and they showcase the amazing range of unique organisms here on Earth. You can grab yours at learningfromnature.earth/merch. I also want you all to know how much I appreciate every review, rating, recommendation, and support, as you are all helping biomimicry reach more people. Together, we can not only imagine, but create a beautiful world with life at the forefront and guiding the way.